Hey everyone, it's James here. Before we get started with this incredible episode of the Oasis podcast, I just wanted to remind you that in my day job, I'm an independent financial advisor. So if you're in the UK and are looking for help with investments, pensions, mortgages, insurance, wills, power of attorney, anything like that, feel free to get in touch via oasispod@gmail.com and I would be very happy to help you. Right, on with the show.
All right, it's Liam. I want to thank everyone at the Oasis podcast. As you were.
Hello, and welcome back to the Oasis podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. Hope you guys are all right. We've got a fun show for you today. I'm just recording this intro out walking the dog, as in doing an Adam Buxton, as I call it, but I won't be starting to do the voices though. So today's going to be really good. We've got an interview with Nev Cotty. So Nev, it was set up by the Listen Up guys, with the main thing being that Nev was in Proud Mary. So he was the bass player in Proud Mary, wrote a couple of their songs on their debut album. That Nolan produced, and Gem and Mikey Rowe and Terry Kirkbride played on and stuff. So I thought that would be interesting to find out about those recording sessions. But then actually, when we get into the interview, there's so much more. There's so many more kind of interactions with the guys over the years. It was really, really interesting. So I hope you guys enjoy that one. I'm sure you will. Plus, a few bits of news, I suppose the key thing. Since we last spoke, obviously the Liam and John Squire album and everything is coming out shortly. The last time I podcasted, it was sort of the rumours of what might happen. And we were thinking it would be, come on dog, let's go home. It was going to be an album and a series of gigs and things. They'd all been rumoured, but not actually confirmed. Well, they have now all been confirmed. So yeah, the album is due out on March the 1st. I've got a copy already, which was very exciting. I emailed the Fear PR and they sent me a copy, which was very kind of them. When I say a copy, I mean like a link. I can't really talk about it yet because the embargo doesn't drop until the 18th of February. So that's when we'll be posting a proper review. I really liked it. I think it'll be a very divisive album, similar to the reaction to, you know, Just Another Rainbow and Master Liverpool. We shall see, but as I say, I really liked it. Liam was sounding great, so we'll see. We'll say more when we can. And the other big news, I suppose, is that Oasis have been nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So this is they've been eligible for a couple of years now, because it was like 25 years from your debut album, and then they weren't sort of on the shortlist. They are now on the shortlist, along with Ozzy Osbourne and Foreigner and Mariah Carey, a few other people. Yeah, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is weird because, you know, you think rock and roll, but actually, you know, it's all genres of music. So nominated this year is like Mary J. Blige, Mariah Carey, Eric B. and Rakim. It's like, well, is that rock and roll? And I suppose it all comes from that original kind of pop. It's pop, really, but anyway. Not proper rock and roll, but anyway, they have been nominated. At the moment, it doesn't look like they're going to get in, but we shall see. And I put a tweet out sort of saying, let's imagine it, you know, Noel walks on stage to collect the award and then says, I couldn't have done it without this guy. Here he is, Liam Gallagher. And that's the announcement of the tour and album. But not going to happen. But, you know, we can but dream. And I see Liam has tweeted this morning, it's something along the lines of fuck the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or something like that. So yeah, anyway.
In 2 years, and I apologize for making you feel old, but in 2 years, Oasis will be eligible for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Because it'll be 25 years since the first album comes out.
Thank you very much.
Do you think about that at all, or do you not care?
I've already been approached by the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
In what capacity? Yeah.
In the capacity of the fucking fella from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame came to me and said, do you know in 2 years you'll be eligible for the Hall of Fame.
Ask a stupid question.
And I said, is that right? And he said, yes. And he started going, and I said, let me fucking stop you there. I know what it is. I know what it entails. It won't be fucking happening, okay? And he invited me down to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame itself. And, I was just thinking, wow, where would they... They showed me all these exhibits of Oasis stuff, and it was... it's a great place and all that, but I won't be doing it, I don't think.
Do you think, though, that... I know it's kind of hard, it may be hard to kind of take yourself out of it, but do you think the band deserves to be in?
I certainly think I do. I think there could be a little miniature of me somewhere. A tiny little thing with a wobbly head.
You could go and induct yourself. Where you be the
inductor? Oh, I do that on a regular basis. Don't you worry about that. These world tours are long. I induct myself every night into it. Don't worry about that.
There we go. But I was also talking, because like we're saying, like, you know, Mary J. Blige and Eric B. and Rakim in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's not very rock and roll. Well, I was thinking, well, why don't we start a Britpop Hall of Fame? So I was talking to Nick from Britpop Revival, James from Britpop Memories, and Mark from Brits and Pieces. So I think we'll form the panel, and we will set up the Britpop Hall of Fame. So to coincide with when the new Hall of Fame, the proper Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, is nominated. So it'd be interesting to hear from you. Who was your nominations? Who should be in there? I think that the inaugural main four will be the big four of Britpop, which is Oasis, Blur, Pulp, Suede. But yeah, who else do you think should be in there? Whether it be bands or other people, like who deserves a place in the Britpop Hall of Fame? Someone like McGee should be in there, Brian Cannon, Chris Evans, you know what I mean? Someone like that, I suppose he was quite important. Stuart McConey, you know, there's all these people that have had that, a big impact on what became Britpop. So that will be something for the future. Liam and John have been doing plenty of promotion. It's been interesting, actually. Obviously, like, John is not the most exuberant talker, but he's still quite funny. And he's had a couple of little zingers and one-liners here and there. They did the Zoe Ball breakfast show, and that was quite entertaining. So, it's been interesting, but not kind of, you know, to be honest, I've not really hunted out and listened to all of them that they've done in full, just because, you know, it's not that engaging. So, it's been fine. Nice to have them out there.
You got a new album out, March the 1st. John, what can we expect?
Greatness. Yeah, that's the word.
Okay, how long have some of these songs been kicking around for? How far back do they some of them stretch?
When was that rehearsal for Nebworth that I came to?
Yeah, that would have been about 2 weeks. Whenever Nebworth was.
Yeah.
2 weeks before.
About 2 weeks before, John come down just... You know,
Champagne
Supernova like he needs to rehearse it.
Just after that, I started on the first tune.
I've got your album track list. Liam, what is your favourite track on the album? What would you really, apart from, it could be the one we've heard. But.
Well, obviously I like Come On, and obviously songs, certain different songs do different things. Some make you want to kick someone in the shin.
Yes.
Some make you want to go out and party.
Yes.
And some make you want to sit at home and just have a good old think.
Right.
And a little cry. So there's different. But so for the one that makes me emotional, Mother Nature's song is a killer.
Okay, that's the last song on the album.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. It sort of really stops me in my tracks and makes me think.
Oh, and I am going to Reading. I've booked for Reading Festival. I couldn't get tickets for Liam and John. And at the moment, as we speak, I haven't got tickets for Definitely Maybe shows. But that Reading lineup with Prodigy and Pendulum and various other people, I thought, yeah, come on, let's do it. So yeah, I'm doing a full weekend at Reading. So if you're going to Reading, we could maybe arrange a podcast meetup or something like that. All right, anyway, that will do it then. Let's go over to my interview with Nev Cotti. I'll see you on the other side.
Time will say nothing, but I told you so. If I could tell you, I would let you know. Suppose we all just get up and go. If I could tell you, I would let you know. Perhaps the flowers really wanna grow, and feathered fortunes want to be told. If I could tell you, I would let you know. Time will say nothing, but I told you so.
Welcome for making his debut on the Oasis podcast, Nev Cotty. How you doing, man?
I'm good, thanks. I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, all good. All good. It's a pleasure to have you on. And yeah, I know it's one of these people that I've been meaning to get someone on who was, you know, part of Proud Mary, especially around that debut album for a long time. And it's like almost what happened with Greg and with Paul, but we never quite made it happen. So yeah, really excited to get you on for that, and also to talk about your other stuff, because obviously, you know, fantastic career outside of that as well.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah, well, fire away. Where do you want to begin?
Well, I was going to take it back to like where you grew up, and so you're Manchester, but are you Manchester or are you like Oldham, like the other guys?
Yeah, I'm born in Royton, which is like a part of Oldham. And yeah, just started kicking around in bands when I was sort of 15, 16. My brother, a bit older than me. That time, obviously, you had the Roses, the Mondays. I mean, I was born in 74, so I went to Alexander Palace. I think that was 89. Went to Spike Island. So it was a very exciting time, you know. I was 15, 16. And like I say, my brother's a bit older. So he was sort of coming back home with these amazing records from these new bands that we could kind of relate to because they were from Oldham and from Sale and from wherever. And then getting into the classic stuff as well, obviously your Beatles, your Lou Reed, your Bowie. So it was an amazing time, really. That's when I started learning guitar and just hung around with those people who were into rock and roll. And what was interesting, because you've got to remember that time, it was a completely different sort of musical landscape, because there was kind of dance music and there was rock and roll, and never the twain should meet. In later years, I've seen that as complete bullshit. But at the time, it was quite entrenched. You know, you're into guitars or you're into dance music. And that's when we sort of... let's go back a bit. So I was in a few bands knocking around. And then I started roadieing for a band called the Ya-Ya's, come out of Royton. And I say roadieing, but I was just hanging around, drinking beer and, you know, passing guitars around. And the Ya-Ya's were doing all right, doing a few gigs around Oldham. And we ran into Noel one day at I can't remember where it was, some gig in Royton Assembly Hall, which is no longer there. I think it might have been, is it the Milltown Brothers? Someone like that. Anyway.
That sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah. And anyway, like I say, there was people, that thing was taking off. The whole Hacienda thing had been happening, you know, sort of 87, 88, 89. And it really was, if you're into like guitar music, you sort of gravitated towards each other. It's sort of all the other people who are into, you know, dance music. I do love dance music now. Like I say, I've kind of reevaluated it and realized how much I did love that music at the time. But you were kind of like, no, I'm into guitars. I'm into rock and roll. And yeah, we sort of befriended Noel at this gig, and he was very sort of affable and what's the word? He was a good team player, Noel. He was like good at getting everyone together. And he said, right, you're in this band, the Ya-Ya's. We're in a band. Let's do some gigs. And that's what transpired. The Ya-Ya's and Oasis did about, I don't know, 10 gigs together back in the day. I think the first one was in Dartford. We went to Dartford Poly for some bizarre reason, all the way down there. And it was like a Manc invasion. They didn't know what had hit them. It was like this polytechnic student night. on a Thursday or something. And we took a crew down, they took a crew down, and it was just carnage, really. I think the place got trashed. And that was the sort of... it's not a very admirable thing to own up to, but it was just the way it was then. There was just a bunch of scallies running wild in a university, you know. And the gig was great. And then, yeah, we just sort of... Both bands said, right, we'll sort of gig out. You support us. They sort of gig out. And the Yardas would support them. Yeah. So loads of gigs at the Boardwalk with about three people listening. You know, Tuesday night at the Boardwalk, Coily the sound guy, us lot, them lot, and about two mates, just dead. But, you know, we loved it. We both loved it. We were heavily obsessed with the Beatles and the Stones. So we were just... Both bands were kind of just heavily into that sort of vibe, you know.
And did you seeing them that early, did you think they're something special, or did you think, well, no, they're a bit shit, or like what?
Well, I think they would own up. I was the roadie, but we weren't great. We were just kids. We were 16, 17, 18 years old. They weren't great, and they didn't have any tunes. The songs were just like two chords, you know, sort of a riff, a groove. They had presence. Liam had presence, you know. You could immediately see with Liam that he was a great front man and he had attitude. But we all kind of had that sort of, you know, attitude at that time, you know, when you're that young. But yeah, the tunes were a bit lacking. And the sound, it was full on Coily, had it, everything turned up. It was all about as loud as you can go. You know, you're in the Boardwalk with three people and it's like ear-bustingly loud, you know, ridiculously loud. But that's what it was all about, you know, who can make the loudest noise. And so we kind of kicked around for a year or so doing these gigs. Not much was happening. We used to go to the Hacienda all the time. And like I say, you've got to remember that time. It was full on, you know. There was a lot of, it was the full like ecstasy scene. So we used to get stuck in like everyone else with the drugs, but we'd stand in the bar talking about Neil Young and the Birds. And everyone else would be dancing on podiums and it'd be us lot wearing stupid anoraks, ridiculously large anoraks, and going on off our heads about how much, you know, we're into Crosby, Stills and Nash and the Stones and stuff. So it was really simpatico with their crew and our crew.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're kicking around and then started hanging around with Noel. Kind of bizarre. I'm sat now in 47 India House, which is my home, has been for the last 23 years. And this was Noel's flat.
Yeah.
Back in the day, yeah, in 1992. So I have these sort of bizarre flashbacks now and again when I remember sort of sitting over there, smoking a joint with Noel, hanging out, you know, on the dole. I had a scooter. I was into scooters and I used to have this Vespa and we used to come down, me and my mate Spot, and we'd sit here all day watching MTV. He had MTV, which was kind of bizarre. He had a flat in town and he had MTV and we just thought that was amazing. You know, like, this is pre-internet, pre-mo. So we used to sit here watching MTV videos, like Beavis and Butthead, smoking dope. And I always remember... They came down one day and we sort of came in and he said, what are you up to? He says, I'm watching this ABBA, the movie. Have you, you know, it's called ABBA, the movie.
Yeah.
It's fucking amazing. The songs are amazing. This is Noel. And we were like, okay, yeah, you know, ABBA, who listens to ABBA? But he was right. You know, the songs were amazing and really crafted. And I always remember that because when they eventually did turn the corner and we went to watch them at a gig at the Boardwalk, and I said to Noel, have you got any new songs? He went, yeah, all of them. And that was rock and roll star, cigarettes and alcohol, you name it. You know, it was just like every song was off that first album. And I always thought, yeah, it is ABBA. The songwriting, you know, the verse, chorus, big chorus, middle eight, that classic songwriting crowd. I always thought Oasis, that first sort of bit was T-Rex, ABBA, and the Sex Pistols combined. Yeah. That's it in a nutshell. It's pop music. It's rock, but it's got that pistol sort of, you know, edge to it. But it's crafted pop hits like T-Rex would write or ABBA would write, you know. I always think of that. And the Bee Gees, we're all into the Bee Gees, early Bee Gees.
Yeah. Yeah.
We used to go out and buy these weird, you've got a lot of albums of Bee Gees in the 60s. And there's some real nuggets. You know, you got your big, like Massachusetts and To Love Somebody, but there's some really good sort of weird psychedelic albums. So yeah, that was kind of the milieu we were moving in, hanging around India House, hanging around the boardwalk and doing gigs. And then one day, he went, yeah, we've got these songs. And it sort of turned a switch for me. It was like, wow, these are brilliant. These are amazing.
That is mad, isn't it? The way it did pretty much turn the dime. Like, you know, when you look at the set list that they were doing in sort of 92, it is, you know, it's pretty basic. It's still a lot of the songs that they were doing with that Liam and Bonehead had put together. Yeah. Like,
you it was know, like a riff.
Tape Me and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I just said to know what's going on there. And it's like, it just wrote these songs one day, I don't know, one week. a nice patch in this. I mean, I've had him back since he came about 2 years ago with CBS America.
Yeah.
I had a full film crew in the flat. And he was just sort of sat in this corner at the back here where my guitars are. And I think he just sat on a stool and wrote all those songs in a week, which is just bizarre, really. You know?
Wow. Does the Manchester Music Tour come to you? You know, Kerry Gill's family do?
Yeah. Well, he's now Gilly. He's in a few bands with Gilly. And great lad. And yeah, they come. I often walk out my door and there'll be like 30 people. And Rose tries to sort of get me involved. I'm like, no.
No, thank you.
I'll be dealing with that. Yeah, so it's on the circuit. It's a beautiful building, India House. It's a listed building.
Yeah.
So the flats are great, you know. I always thought maybe it's... I was 16 when I used to come here, 16, 17. And you just think it was amazing that someone could live in a city centre, which was just unheard of then. Now, everyone lives here, don't they, you know. But he was like, wow, he's got a flat in town and he's got MTV.
MTV.
And we're doing a gig like that. Yeah, we're living the dream. It's great.
And so the Yayas, you know, obviously you've got Paul Newsom there. You've also got Scott McLeod, right?
Yeah, McLeod, Loud McLeod, yeah.
Have we ever, because he is like, you know, it's mad. You've got these like holy grails of people that have been connected with Oasis that we've never managed to track down. Scott McLeod, any leads on Scott McLeod?
Yeah, Scott's a great mate of mine. We lived in a young one style house. Me, Spot, Scott McLeod and a few others used to live together for years. And yeah, he was a great mate for years, Scott, but good luck getting him to do an interview. You've got no chance. Absolutely. He's like Stanley Kubrick meets Lord Lucan, Scott McLeod. Good luck trying to get hold of him. I can't get hold of him. I've not spoken to him for about 15 years.
Oh, okay. But he's alive and well, and
oh yeah, he's a great. Scott's a great guy. Scott was in the Yayas, and then when he did join Oasis, in I think it was right at the height when Wonderwall had just come out.
Yeah,
and I was in a band. He wasn't in the Yayas. He was in a band with me called Saint Jack, and we were rehearsing at Sankey Soap in Manchester at the time. And Bonehead got in touch and said, right, you've got the gig. And he was... The thing with that, what happened there was, you know, one day he's rehearsing with us in a mill in Manchester and, you know, probably signing on or whatever. And then the next day he's on Top of the Pops and he's playing at Earl's Court or wherever it was. And, yeah, he kind of walked on the American tour. the first, he did one gig in, like, New Jersey or something. And then come off stage and said, right, I'm going home. So I think it was just a baptism of fire because they'd sort of, gone from the Boardwalk to doing, you know, the next level of gigs, the club circuit, the toilet tour. And it was a gradual progression for them, although they did go massive at one point, didn't they, and just hit the stadiums. But he just went from, like, mooching around Oldham to being in Oasis. And I think it was just overwhelming, that sort of, that leap, you know.
Yeah. And well,
plus there's a lot of drugs going on at the time.
Yeah. Well, it was said as well he missed his bird and he wanted to go home to his bird. So we must say that must be the fittest bird in the world if he's willing to walk out an Oasis for that.
That's bollocks. Scott's a very, he's his own man, and every band I've been in, he doesn't take shit off anyone. So if someone said the wrong thing to him, don't matter if it's Oasis, the IRs, or say whoever, he'll do his own thing. Scott, he's very strong individual, you know. So it's just bad timing, but it is a bizarre story that because he was only in him for about 8 gigs,
yeah.
I think he could have, you know, I think the gig was his if he wanted to carry on, but circumstances prevailed. Like I say, this is like peak Oasis. You remember how old are you? When were you born?
I'm born 80. So I was 80, like 14 when Definitely Maybe came out. Yeah,
you couldn't get away from them. They were everywhere. It was on the bloody news. It was on every. I remember walking in a newsagent's and every single magazine had them on the front. It was just, you couldn't escape it. So I think it's mind blowing to go from nothing to just into that sort of cauldron of chaos. Yeah. You know, the tabloids, it's on the front of the Sun, every newspaper. Yeah. It was chaos, absolute chaos.
And not just like Roses Mondays level, but like fucking...
Oh, no, it got mainstream.
Pop band level, yeah.
Oh, no, this was, like I say, it was on the news. It was on, they're on the front page of the Sun every day, you know. It's hard to sort of... you get that with a band these days, would you? Who would you get, like, maybe Pete Doherty suffered similar... I say suffered, but it's all good. It's all good, and it's all good publicity. But yeah, they were huge. They're absolutely huge. And I think it was just a massive thing to jump into.
Yeah.
You'll have to try and get hold of him. See, good luck.
If you can help me at all, because I'm sure, you know, we could do something. He could do a signing and make a lot of money. I don't know if he's got.
No, he's not.
If he signed Wonderwall singles, that is a, you know, pound sign.
He's not into it. It's a long time ago. You know, it's just a brief part of his life. You know, I don't think he's, you know, it's just one of them. It's a strange little anomaly. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know
what I
mean? We went for Scott McLeod from a little band that we'd played with in the past called the Yayas. What a great job he got, didn't he? Do you fancy being a bass player in Oasis? Fucking yes.
I don't know how long it was before we got on the plane to go to the States, but even that was chaos.
This is Scott.
We were on the way to New York to do David Letterman. Maggie, our tour manager, God bless that woman, we put her through absolute fucking hell. She came in kind of half laughing, going, you'll never guess what's just happened. Scott's just told me he wants to, like, quit. And I remember going to the back lounge and saying to him, mate, what? And he said these words, I'm just missing me bird.
You know, there's people that are cut out for it and there's people that ain't. He might have just gone, you know what? This is not for me. It's either that or his bird must have been fit as fuck, you know what I mean?
I always take things like that. I would always laugh my way through it and think, even, you know, as you're driving into America to do David Letterman and the bass player that's standing in for the bass player who's got nervous exhaustion is saying, I can't handle it anymore. And we're laughing, going, we must be the biggest bunch of cunts in the world, because our mate is fucking sat at home watching the cricket. He don't want to be in a band with us. This fucking clown here, who's on the dole in England, he don't want to be in a band. I mean, are we like the biggest three cunts in the world? It didn't deter us. We got to New York, Bonehead got up, you're playing bass. And we do it as a four-piece.
Well, it's funny, it's like, I don't know if you ever knew Chris Hutton, who was like the original singer with the Rain before they became Oasis.
I'm aware of him, yeah.
But he's Burnage Way, and he's and once again, I've met him. He did his book after Oasis got massive. He did a book, and I'm in touch with him. Well, I haven't for a while, but I have been in touch with him. I was like, come on, Chris, please come on the podcast. You know, it's so important. You know what I mean? That these people who had such an important role in like one of the biggest bands ever. You know, and you've never done an interview like other than this one book back in the day. And he's just not bothered. He loves he's got his job. He's got his family. He goes and watches United around the world, goes to gigs, not asked, rather just move on. And you think, I completely respect that. But come on, mate, you know.
You know, if you've been connected intimately with it, there's a sort of element of regret there, isn't there? So it's not something you want to dwell on. You know, it's like, could have been me. You know, he's the singer in the band, wasn't he? Or whatever.
He's the singer.
There's a bit of regret there, isn't there? So I guess like you say, some people just want to move on and forget about it and new things or whatever.
Shut up, dog. So. So as we progress from those early days with you hanging out with the Yayas and Noel and being in your house and everything, how does that then move through to you being part of Proud Mary? And then suddenly we go to Noel within just a few years. He's now the biggest kind of rock star in the world. And he comes to produce you, including two songs that you've written on that album. So you're one of the very few people that Noel Gallagher has produced, you know, your song.
This is true. Yeah, so obviously they got signed, Creation, and then they moved to London. So we kind of used to bump into each other now and again, here and there. But yeah, they were off. They were massive. They were around the world, weren't they? And then I was in various other bands, and then it was in Proud Mary, and it was when Bonehead left the band. And I remember, this is what I'm saying, I read it in like the Daily Mirror. I think it was just sat in a cafe, opened the Daily Mirror. It's like, Bonehead leaves Oasis. So I thought, right, well, I'm going to go and join the band. So I drove from Manchester Noel is currently in Olympic Studios in Barnes, London, recording the new album. So all right, I'll just drive down there then. So I drove to Olympic Studios, which is like this legendary. The Stones recorded Sympathy for the Devil in Olympic. They did various albums. Loads of bands have been in there. You know, it's an amazing historic recording studio in London. And then me, like, you know, what am I now, 25, rocks up there in the Ford Cortina, whatever I was driving in, parked right outside, walked in and went, right, can I see Noel Gallagher? And they're like, can you wait there? So I sat there and he comes out and he said, what the fuck are you doing here? I said, I've come to join your band, your guitarist has left. And he was laughing, we had a brew. And then he's just saying, what are you up to? I said, well, I'm in this band, Proud Mary. We're doing all right. We've done a few gigs. And he said, right, well, send us the demo and I'll let you know about the guitar. I said, who's going to join? I said, I've been reading Johnny Marr's joining the band. He's like, no, Johnny Marr's not joining. So I'm like, well, let us know. You know, there's my number. You know, put my hat in the ring or whatever. Again, pre-mobile phones. He's like, remember, we always used to have, you know, these little address books. Carry this address book and go to a phone box, you know. Anyway, left me number and then thought, well, I've not heard anything. It was like 99, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then me and Spot out of the band, we just went traveling around Asia, backpacking. Thought, right, it's the millennium. Let's go and have a party somewhere. We ended up in Thailand. I remember reading like a copy of Mojo. It was really near like the millennium, you know, it was a big thing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
1999. Just sat in this bar in Thailand. It's like an interview in Mojo. Because it's all about the end of Creation. What are you going to do? Creation's ended now.
Yeah.
He said, right, I'm going to start my own label.
and I'm going to sign two bands, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, just because of the name. I don't think he'd even heard them at that point. And us, on the basis of this demo that we did on a four-track Tascam, you know, in someone's back room. You know, so he said, they sound like the Rolling Stones, circa 68. Sort of, you know, Let It Bleed, 68, 69. So we were like, right, well, that sounds okay, doesn't it? So we'll celebrate the millennium, then we'll go home. And
hold on, so he hadn't phoned you and told you he was signing you?
No, we just read it. We read it in Mojo, you know, Mojo magazine.
That's good to know. This is it.
We were on the road in Thailand, you know. I think email was just starting, you know. This is it. We read it. It was like, hey, look at that. He's into us. So then we got home and then, we all sort of put it together and we went down to Wheeler End, which is, you familiar with Wheeler End?
Yeah. High Wycombe Way, yeah.
Exactly. So I went there and recorded the album, yeah. And great producer, Gem. It was kind of Gem and Noel together who produced it. Gem's a great guitarist and a great all-rounder. And they were a great team for bouncing ideas and all that business, yeah. So it's amazing, really. Amazing studio.
It's funny looking at it because, you know, if you think, I compare it to, you know, you're a big Beatles fan. You know, when Jackie Lomax did like Sour Milk Sea and it was like written by George, most of the Beatles played on it, you know, and it was like the closest to a Beatles song that wasn't the Beatles. Whereas when you look at that Same Old Blues album, it's like Mike Rowe plays on it, Strange Boy mixes it, like, you know, Noel records it. Even your track, the fifth track on it, Noel counts it in. You know what I mean?
Noel's playing a lot of the acoustic guide track, which we've kept in the end. And we used his system, you know, he always plays to a click. I don't know if he's changed that now, but, you know, do it to a click. It was like acoustic and the drums. Terry Kirkbride, who's a great drummer. I don't know if you have interviewed Tez.
No, I've never interviewed Terry actually. He's another lovely guy. He's not on social media or anything, so he's hard to track down.
No, he's another Scott McLeod. Tez is great, amazing drummer. He's a mate of Gems. He's from up that end.
Yeah.
You know, Castleway or South Shields or that. So yeah, Noel had his system, and obviously he got the sound in there, which is like his amps, his microphones, his mixing desk. So. Yeah. It has got that Oasis. I mean, it's top. Yeah, we've gone from recording on a four track to being in one of the best studios in the world.
One, two, three, four. Holy call me to say that he was upon a hill, not gone. Today, said it was such a shame, but if you know what you know, don't even try complain. Come on, give me some of your precious time. I know you like the music playing so fine.
And I remember turning up there and he gave me a little tour. It's a beautiful place. Like you're saying, High Wycombe. It's like horses, farmland. It's like a residential. You get your own little room and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, come here, have a look at this. So like the live room's just like loads of beautiful AC30s and Marshalls and everything, vintage amplifiers. And then you go upstairs and there was this room, this like loft, and there was one side of a wall and that said, Telecasters, and then it said Rickenbackers, and then it said Gibsons, and it said semi-acoustic, and it was just like this room of about 300 guitars, and he went, take whatever you want. So, and he used to pass them, so that was above the live room, and you pass the guitars down, there was a little hole, so we were just like kids in a candy shop. I was just playing, getting all these crazy, all these guitars out and messing around, until one day, I pulled out one morning. I mean, we were all drinking and all that while we were recording it. And Noel would bugger off at about 6 o'clock. He always did like sort of 10 till six. It was working. I think he keeps that philosophy now.
Yeah.
So when he went, it was like, right, Headmaster's gone. Let's get drinking. So we were like on it, boozing. I remember getting his Les Paul out, and I was there, you know, playing along. Liam came down one night and we had a jam, if you could even call it that. And I just left all the guitars out, and then Jason Rhodes, his roadie, turned up at like 9 in the morning, absolutely going mental, because all the guitars were left, all the amps were left turned on, all that. And I'd left this Gibson Les Paul lent, you know, like you should never leave it on an amp on right. the neck.
Yeah.
If someone knocks it, it's getting broken straight
yeah,
away.
Yeah.
And that was to be Townsend's. And he give it Johnny Marr, and Johnny Marr give it Nolan. It's worth like, you know, 300 grand. And I'd been there like drunkenly, you know, pretending I was Jimmy Page the night before. So yeah, they quickly got put away, and it was like, don't touch the guitars anymore, you know. We'll get the guitars out for you. But it's good fun, you know. We worked hard doing that album. It was like a song a day, and you know, it was done in 2 weeks. Bish bash bosh. It was there was no messing about, overthinking it. It was like, here's the songs, here's the band, and get it down. I think it's a good album.
Good album. And that spirit really comes through on it, I think. Like it feels like those old 60s recordings where it is, you know, it's not been farted around with for months. It is just like pretty much the live takes and it sounds great.
Yeah, thanks. Oh, no, it's a good album. I think it stands up and it's just got a really good production value on it.
Yeah, and it was what I find interesting as well with the Oasis historian hat on, is that it's got like, if you think Oasis sound changed, so if they had their 90s kind of sound, you know, obviously each album sort of changed in its own way, and then you go that Standing on the Shoulder of Giants era, like when Bonehead left and Griggs left, when you were putting your hat in the ring, but so Noel's pretty much just doing that by himself with Strange Boy kind of doing a lot of the production and the sort of psychedelic effects and stuff on that one. Whereas then, like, he works on Proud Mary stuff, which is that much more stripped back and, like, that kind of bluesy 60s influenced. But, like, you know, like you say, rootsy late 60s rather than psychedelic, you know, 67 sort of thing.
Definitely.
And then that's where it kind of goes next. And I suppose then you've got Andy Bell in the band and you've got Gem in the band, so they're much more into that. So you can feel like that Proud Mary album is almost like a signpost for which route they went down into the 2000s, where they became much more of a just straight out rock and roll band again.
That's a good analysis. I'd agree with that. I think you're right that Andy and Gem brought a lot to the table. They were producing their own albums at that point, and you know, Noel had learned what he wanted to do. But I think you're right that, what's it called, Standing on the Shoulder of Giants, that was a kind of pivotal album because Noel was doing it on his own.
Yeah,
you got to think the first one. What was it, Owen Morris?
Yeah,
did he do the second one as well? Can't remember.
Yeah, and the third one, and then the fourth one.
That's the real changing point, isn't it? You're right, because they had those three albums written. Like when we used to go down to they rehearsed at the Boardwalk, and they'd be playing that. What's that? All Around the World.
Yeah,
which was on the third album. So they were rehearsing that back in '92, and I remember him saying, "Yeah, we've got three albums written." So that's the turning point, and you're right, you know, you can't underestimate how good Gem is as a musician. In the studio, like, let's put this on. A lot of the Proud Mary stuff, it was just little ideas, you know, little guitar parts that really elevate the song. So they were great in the studio, producer players, you know, which is what you want. And Strange Boy as well, we did a few demos with Strange Boy. Proud Mary, he had a studio in Lavender Hill, South London. So he used to go down. And I think Noel did a lot with him around that time in that studio, Strange Ways.
Yeah.
Just a little studio down there. So I think him and Strange Boy were doing quite a lot, on those next subsequent albums,
Yeah, I've always said Strange Boy's probably like the unsung hero of Oasis, especially in the later years, because he's never been officially a member. But yeah, his stamp is all over later years, and then into Noel Solo as well.
I agree. I concur. I completely agree. Yeah, good.
And he's
lad.
Another
great
one that
guitarist.
Won't do a bloody interview.
He won't.
No. I've had it because he produced. There's a couple of people that have said, "Oh, he'd be brilliant," and I've had his number. I texted him, but it just never materialized. I think to be honest, a lot of people that still work with one of the brothers are just a bit. Yeah, especially because it's called Oasis Podcast. They're like, oh, hold on, is that going to piss Noel off? And like, maybe,
who cares? You know what I mean? It's all good, isn't it? It's all good.
Yeah,
but, Strange Boy's great. Great guitarist. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. While it's going so good. When you hit your stride, you should just
I mean, it's a great time. Like I say, it was 25. The band were all about 25, 26. Greg, great lead singer in the band. We did the album. And then he said, right, there's the keys to the van, the splitter van. Go and do some gigs. And we were just doing the toilet tour, the length and breadth of the land, you know, from Aberdeen to Bournemouth. We were there doing every single gig. You know, loved it. Every night we're gigging. But what was bizarre was, you'd say, right, we're in the... I don't know, York Fibbers tonight. We've got a day off tomorrow. Great. We can mess about. And then we get this call. It said, you're supporting Ryan Adams tomorrow. And you're like, okay, wow. Great. And then so we did some great supports. Ryan Adams was great. Weller, we did a load of gigs with Weller. He was a real gentleman and really looked after us. And Neil Young. And I remember, I think we'd finished a tour and we were like knackered. You know, we'd been on the road. And you just think, right, great, go home and sleep for about a week. And he said, right, you're supporting Neil Young tomorrow in Ireland. And we're like, okay. So we drove over to Ireland and supported Neil Young.
No.
I did about 2-3 shows with Neil Young, which was kind of bizarre because, you know, from going from the Hacienda, talking to Noel off your head about, you know, Neil Young. Like, Neil Young's like this mythological...
Yeah.
It's like you're never going to meet Neil Young. He's from California. He's lived in Laurel Canyon. He's a god. And then, you know, you're shaking his hand and he's chatting to you about your album, you know, and you're like, wow, this is next level, you know, and hanging around with Crazy Horse, having a beer with Crazy Horse after the show. So it was magical times, but it's just bizarre doing these, you know, great little gigs where it was like 100 people going mad and then supporting these arenas. And then we ended up, we did Finsbury Park with Oasis. We did loads of Oasis shows.
Yeah.
We did 3 nights at Finsbury Park with them. That was a good one.
Yeah. Yeah.
That
I mean, anything.
Great lineup. It's like a different lineup every day.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. And did anything stand out from those gigs?
Yeah. No, they were great. I love it. I was on bass. So it was like Easy Street for me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not. Not dismissing the role of the bass player, but come on, you know, it was pretty simple stuff. So I just soaked it in. And for example, that Finsbury Park, I think we were on at midday. So we'd done it at 12:30. And then it was like the Coral, Black Rebel, Shaq, then Oasis. And then the next day it was a whole different lineup. It was like, this is amazing. I'm backstage. You know, I was on the beer at that point, and it was just an amazing time, you know, just enjoying it. Enjoying. Mm. They were massive, weren't they? You forget how big Oasis were, and you were just well looked after, and it just, you met some great people and had some great times. So I look back very fondly on that period. It was we just had a laugh. Didn't take it too seriously. Yeah. It's a bit of a laugh. Yeah.
I think even in those later years as well, people don't, because everyone always talks about the rise and the, you know, up to Nebworth. And it's almost like, well, the story didn't end at Nebworth. You know what I mean? Like they carried on and did amazing stuff and were still like headlining huge. I mean, look at them now, flipping, you know, Liam and John Squire hitting the charts, their album's going to probably go to number one. You know what I mean? They're still absolutely massive.
They were massive till they broke up. They were huge, you know, and doing stadiums and shit. So, and that's it. It was a laugh. Everyone, you know, it was good. I don't know about their sort of dynamic within the band. It didn't sound too great in the end. But when I was there, it was just everyone having a good time and, you know, a lot of drinking and whatnot. But it was good times and just enjoying it. You get a bit older and a bit wiser and you get a bit bored with all that, don't you? So things move on. Things move on. But yeah, so I was in Primary for a couple of years. We did all that business. And then we went our separate ways with Sour Mash, which is Noel's label, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then the band continued, but I just started doing my own solo stuff. Started releasing that in 2012. And I've done 5 albums now.
Like a ship out of the water, stranded on the shore, I was looking out for freedom when you walked through the door. I picked up my guitar, Spanish songs we would sing. Now I only hear the echo since you gave back the rain.
Just to emphasize that sort of it was glorious, really, when we were just starting out, because obviously, like, both bands, the Yayas and the Oasis, wanted to be, you know, we wanted to get a deal like you did back then. But it was good fun, you know what I mean? I don't know how it is now with kids these days, whatever, but I don't want to sound patronized or anything. But it was just about, the main thing was having a laugh. And then, you know, sort of, you wanted your band to be successful and you wanted to do it, but you got to have fun while you're doing it, you know. And, you know, Oasis were, they rehearse like every night. You know, say what you've been up to is like, we're rehearsing. But then they go and have a beer, you know what I mean? It wasn't all doom and gloom. It was like, get the graft on and then enjoy yourself. But it was, it was a great time. Like I said, you know, what was weird was I kind of thought the Roses had finished at that point. They kind of had. They disappeared, hadn't they, you know? And in my head, what Oasis were doing in the early stages, I thought, do we really want to, we've got to move this on from, you can't just repeat what's happened before with the Roses. And they did take it somewhere new, you know what I mean? But initially they were hankering after that sound, you know what I mean? That sort of Manchester, what became known as Manchester. No one called it that at the time. But yeah, I was a bit dismissive of them earlier on, especially when, you know, before the big tunes came along. I thought, is this just sort of like, we've got that 88, you know, Spike Island was what, 88, 89, or was it 90, Spike Island? Yeah. This is 2 years after, you know, and when you're young, that's a long time, you know. Yeah. A week's a long time. Now you can knock off a year and not even remember it. But then you're like, this has got to go, you know, we can't be hankering after the sort of glory days of 88. But then they did sort of take the bull by the horns and move things on, make it more song-based, wasn't it? Yeah. You know, you think of the Roses and the Mondays, they're kind of like jamming bands in the end. They turned into, you know, sort of quite long jamming songs. That's how the songs were written. You think of like Fool's Gold and the later Monday stuff. I'm not dismissing that. I think it's amazing. But the songwriting, that's why that ABBA thing was really sort of, I think Noel got the fact that you need a pop song to get on top of the pops. Do you know what I mean? And an 8-minute groove, you know, and the Mondays did make it onto the top of the pops and they had some great songs, but it was all about, there's a lot of craft going into it, you know? You know, the Beatles, you say the Beatles, but you've got to look at T-Rex and the Bee Gees and those other influences at that time. That sort of thing. I'll tell you a story. When I used to come to this flat, I used to just pop down on my scooter and I said, oh, you know, have you got any demos of your stuff?
cassettes, obviously. And he went, there you go. And he gave me 6 cassettes full of rehearsals, outtakes, all the stuff they'd done in the studio that weren't getting used. I had these 6 and I was that skint. We were all skint. Everyone was skint. I actually recorded all over them. I recorded just my own demos and stuff, yeah. So I had loads of stuff, loads of mad stuff, you know, just in the rehearsal room being taped and stuff like that. I gave him, we did a swap. I had some Beatles, rare Beatles stuff that my brother had managed to get his hands on VHS. He used to buy not original, but VHS that a geezer had copied some stuff on for 25 quid in the Corner Exchange in Manchester. He'd say, yeah, it's a Beatles concert in, you know, in wherever, Germany in 1963. And you just couldn't get, you know, no YouTube, no nothing. You're never going to hear it. You're never going to see it unless you buy it. And 25 quid was an astronomical sum. So he'd buy these VHS, you know, a plain, no package, no cover, anything. He'd just say, Beatles live. So I had loads of Beatles footage and I lent him, no, never got them back. So if you do ever speak to him, that's your first, where are my Beatles videos? That's what I want to know. I mean, you could, like now, you just go da-da-da-da and you can see everything in a second,
yeah.
Can't you?
Yeah.
You've got to believe how hard it was to get a hold of stuff that you wanted to listen to, you know. Even those Beatles songs that people didn't have.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You just couldn't get them. And there was another guy in near Johnny Roadhouse in Manchester. And you go in, and it was like this Aladdin's cave of vinyl, you know. And we all wanted the performance soundtrack, you know, the film Performance.
Yeah.
Nick Rogue film. And no one could get hold of a copy. And he said, right, I've got them. How much do you want for it? He went, 50 quid. And we were like, right, do we 50? That's a lot of money for a record. And we said, right, we'll club together and get it. And he meant 50 quid for a cassette. He said he'd do a cassette recording of the album and sell it us for 50 quid. And we just told him to piss off, you know. But that's, you're just dealing in like stuff that's hard to get hold of, you know.
Yeah.
That's why you gravitated. That's why subcultures came together, because we gravitated towards Noel because he was into the same stuff as us. And we could share Beatles videos and demos. You know? That's how you came together under that banner of music, you know.
That is mad.
Yeah, taped over the cassettes.
Mate, I'm not going to tell you how much they'd probably be worth now because you.
One of the, and he used to give us guitars. We used to swap guitars, and he gave me this Jag, and I think I sold it for like 100 quid or 150 quid, just stuff like that. You don't, when you skin and someone offers you some money, you take it. You're not thinking like down the line, what's this going to be worth? You just get rid of it. Yeah, so it's loads of amps and stuff like that we used to share, you know.
I was going to say, from those early days, it's funny because I suppose it's Manchester being that bit smaller, like you say, and that sort of community of people that are into their music. Because I always thought it was weird. Thank you. I always thought it was weird that Oasis, so early on, I think their second gig, they supported Revenge, Peter Hook's band, in Oldham.
Did they?
Yeah.
In Oldham?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. I think it was like the first gig they did outside of the Boardwalk.
And you think, it might have been with the Ayaz, that might have been. I'm not sure.
And it's like, how did that happen? You know, and then you've got the whole thing about Johnny Marr, you know, helping him in the early days. And they recorded with, even before they became Oasis, when Chris Hutton was still in the band, they'd recorded with Andy Rourke, I think. So, or who was it? Rourke or Joyce, I can't remember. So it's so funny that, you know, like, The scene must have been pretty small, that like that's just, you know, these sort of local bands that had nothing going for them really, and yet they're mixing with Peter Hook and guys from the Smiths, you know what I mean?
I once gave Noel Gallagher a guitar, and it was through my brother Ian, and he'd introduced me to Noel and everything, and they were just sort of starting out, and I'd been to a couple of gigs and they played to, you know, 8 people and a dog sort of thing, and Noel was asking me what I thought of one of the gigs one time, and I said to him, well, you know, it's great, it's fantastic, but you've really got to get another guitar, because, you know, he used to stand with his back to the audience in between songs, and he'd look at this big tuner, and I'd say, you're spending ages tuning up, you know, you could go at the bar and have a drink and come back and you're still tuning up, you know, and you need another guitar, just get one. You know, and quite rightly he said to me, well, that's all right for you to say, you know, I'm on the dole, you know, I've got like 12 quid and, you know, you've got like 100 guitars, so, you know, it's all very well, but I'm skint, you know, so I thought, oh, all right, of course, yeah. So I said, oh, well, look, I'll lend you one of mine. And, you know, his eyes lit up like that. So I went back to my house and thought, well, you know, what guitar can I give him? I can't give him one that's too sort of dodgy or cheap or whatever. You know, I've got to give him a decent one. So I had this Sunburst 1960 Gibson Les Paul, worth a fortune. It was then, but it is now. And I got it from Pete Townsend. And I just thought, oh yeah, I'll lend him that. It's all right, it really buzz him up, you know. So no one knew of him at this time. So I saw him and went, yeah, look, yeah, you can borrow that. You can have that as your spare guitar. So he immediately was like, that became his main guitar. But they took off very quickly after that. Around that time, they got a lot of attention. And it was almost like a few weeks passed and I was reading in the music press, it's like Johnny Margive's band guitar. And Oasis just sat in the other one. The way he'd made it out was like he and I had met on this grassy knoll at midnight under a full moon, like that, in our shades. And I'd walked up onto the knoll and I'd passed him the Les Paul, like Excalibur.
It's tiny. Manchester City Centre's tiny. You know, you compare it to London. London's a metropolis, isn't it, with loads of little boroughs that no one sort of leaves or whatever. So Manchester, and yeah, and the fulcrum was, you know, at that time, the Hacienda, like everyone went. And if you were cool, you went to the Hacienda. And there was all the other people. It's different now, isn't it? You know, culture's far more, what's the word? I don't know. It's easily, like I mentioned before, it's easily accessible. So everyone can get into it. You had to work for it. So you had back then you had the mainstream, which was like Phil Collins in the charts, utter shit, you know, in the charts. And then there were people who were into music and that was like, you know, this separate thing altogether. It's kind of a mishmash now, isn't it? You don't know what's what. So you would go to the Boardwalk or the Hacienda or wherever it may be, these mad like raves and stuff going on, just warehouse parties that you'd go like follow each other to. And then there was the mainstream, you'd go to Discotheque Royale in Piccadilly. You know, when you'd walk past them and they'd be wearing suits and they were like completely separated from what you were into, you know. It was like a very... So if you were cool, for want of a better word, you kind of gravitated towards each other. Right, are you into the Beatles? Right, well, let's have a chat about that. You know, it was like, that's how it was. It was... I'm sure that goes on, you know. I'm sure that goes on now, but that's how it happened for us. Yeah. And it was just it's a really fertile time because... That whole Stone Roses thing was just amazing, absolutely amazing. I thought that was normal because I was 15 and I thought, right, well, this is what it's going to be like forever. I'm going to grow up here. There's going to be these amazing bands every 2 years. We're going to be going to concerts. You know, I just thought that was the norm. Go to the Hacienda. There's all these new drugs coming out. There's all this amazing dance music. And I just thought that was the normal way of things, you know, and it would continue forever. Looking back, it's just a little pocket, isn't it, of amazing creativity and whatnot at that time.
Yeah.
So it's just great to be a part of that. It really was.
Yeah. Did you get involved much with the real people and you know, from Liverpool? Because how Oasis sound sort of changed from that much more long drawn out jams to like these short, sharp pop songs. And I always sort of triggered that it was sort of them rehearsing with the real people at their studio that was sort of that made them, because they had really, you know, really good kind of condensed sort of 3-4 minute pop songs.
Yeah I was aware of that. Because obviously through the Carpets you kind of knew more people, you know, over in Liverpool. What's he called, Diggsy Smaller, were they called?
Yeah
And your Scousers are always going to write pop songs, aren't they, you know. That's their thing, isn't it? You know, when you grow up in the city that produced the Beatles, you're never going to escape that. So they were more, I guess if you wanted to sort of simplify it, your Mondays, your Roses, like I said, were more groove based. You know, you've got Gaz Whelan playing for the Mondays, who's playing that sort of what's the word, kraut rock type beat, you know, a straight beat, a groove, you know, you think of something like Rope for Luck or whatever it is. It's the same drum beat all the way through, you know, and it's just a great, get the bass line in and you're away, and Ryder sort of rapping over it. And similarly with the Stone Roses, with Rennie, you know, what an amazing drummer. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it turned into this groove thing, whereas your Scousers are just, we're always more song-based, you know, verse, chorus, all of that sort of stuff, you know. So, yeah, I think that's a valid point, that Noel was influenced by that, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, we're so close together, Liverpool and Manchester. Everyone talks about, you know, it's only football that separates us. I've always got on with, like, whenever you go over to Liverpool and meet a load of musicians, always top lads, you know, and produce great, you know, and always really just the same people, aren't they, Manx and Scousers? It's only the football that bullshit that sort of stokes it all up and makes it a bit toxic. But we're just all into music, all inspired by the same thing. You got the sort of Celtic, you know, it's like a second generation Irish, isn't they, in Liverpool and Manchester? So you got that Irish musical influence. It's tight. We're more similar than we'd like to profess, you know.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Well, let's just talk about your stuff as well, Nev, because I, you know, to be honest, I wasn't aware of your stuff until I kind of, you know, it was actually Listen Up Guys, who I think you've done a few bits with, and you know, and I thought, all right, yeah, and yeah, I really enjoyed it. It's fantastic. It's got that, this just that sort of really chilled kind of. Lee Hazelwood, you know, Leonard Cohen, Scott Walker. It reminded me as well of like Beck, his Karma Moments. You know, Beck's done that, you know, in the band Air, the French band Air, that very much like chilled sort of, you know, and then your voice is like the real deep kind of Richard Hawley sort of voice. I've really enjoyed it. I've been loving it for the last couple of weeks.
Thank you very much. Yeah, well, I think you've hit all the key elements there. That's I just wanted to, I'd kind of done the Proud Mary thing, which was our version of being in the band.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were obsessed with the band and Dylan and Neil Young and the Byrds. So that was that sort of thing done. And I kind of wanted to move away and, towards that. Yeah, something that wasn't as rock and roll. I always wrote songs that were too high for me to sing. And I was like, why are these sounding shit? You know, writing these songs, trying to be like the Rolling Stones. And then it was my mate Carwin, who's in a band called Colorama. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's a great musician, Carwin Ellis.
Yeah.
He just said, well, why are you singing, like, you know, wait, you're singing, wait, your voice is not there. You know, it's there. And then you listen to Lee Hazelwood and Leonard and you go, oh, right, this is a different thing. This, it can be, you know, you think of Jim Morrison sang very low. If you think of the Doors, you don't realise it because they're a great band, like a sort of pop rock and roll band. But Morrison's right down there as well. So I just sort of tailored the music to fit my voice and got into like Scott Walker and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I always remember when I was at school, I was told like by the, you know, the music teacher trying out for a school play, and I'd had the best of the Doors, and in the liner notes, it had said Morrison's rich baritone. And then the guy was like, okay, so you're a baritone. And I was like, I'm a baritone. That's what Morrison is, you know. And that was just such a big deal for me to hear that. I didn't know
what
it
meant. If you've got a great baritone, use it. I mean, Jim Morrison was into like Sinatra. If you listen, you know, tell all the people that you see. It's like crooning.
Yeah,
He's kind of in that, you know, that Tony Bennett, Frank Sinatra world.
Yeah,
that's what he wanted. It's not what he wanted to be, but they were his singing heroes.
Yeah.
So you kind of miss that with Morrison. Great singer, amazing singer.
Yeah.
Tell all the people that you see, follow me. Follow me down. Tell all the people that you see. Set them free. Follow me down. You tell them they don't have to run. We're gonna pick up everyone.
So I brought, you know, I kind of found my voice, for want of a better phrase, and then I hooked up with this producer guy in Wales, Mason Neely, and yeah, he's amazing, bringing that modernity to it, like you say about Beck, and you know, I love those air records are amazing, aren't they?
Yeah,
just the sort of future retro vibe to it, you know.
It's a good way to put it. And I know you mentioned, I read an interview, you mentioned that like Serge Gainsbourg's one of your big heroes. And I absolutely love Gainsbourg. And you can hear him all over production, Beck.
Yeah. So like with this guy, Mason, he's an amazing, you know, he's a tech head. He's into computers and he knows what he's doing and microphones and all the stuff that is available these days. So when you listen to something like Melody Nelson, you're like, what the fuck is going on there? That's like the maddest thing I've ever heard. Can we do it? You know, that's the idea. So nothing's off the table. I love mad production. I do love production, like records that have been sort of curated and really, really sort of thought about. You know, Scott Walker, some of the greatest production ever committed to vinyl. It's just amazing stuff.
Yeah, I agree. It's
just people... You know, it's a record of the way something sounds. You know, it's all about sound, isn't it? You know, so let's get the sound right.
Yeah.
That's what I'm kind of down with. So I'm just about to go in the studio, actually. You mentioned Richard Orley. I'm going him with his band, Colin the bass player, and Shares the guitarist, and Dean the drum, do some recording with them in a couple of weeks.
Excellent.
So that'll be interesting.
That'd be great. Look forward to that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm nicking Hawley's band.
Well, actually, you couldn't nick much better bands than that.
Exactly.
You get to sound like him. Amazing.
Lost in a hurricane. That's why I changed my name today.
But I was going to say on the, I remember Jarvis Cocker being interviewed and him saying, like, you know, the Beach Boys. He's like, I never liked the Beach Boys. Like, I think because they sung too high. He always gravitated the same thing towards Gainsbourg and Scott Walker and people like that, that sort of that deep, rich voice. And, you know, whether it's almost spoken at times. And there's something just really, you know, I love the Beach Boys, you know, with the soaring harmonies and stuff. But there is something really lovely about that kind of just chill, like you're in a bar, Tom Waits, you know, that sort of feeling.
You've got your voice. You can't, you know, you've only got one voice. So you can't be writing songs, you know, you can't imagine Pulp doing a Beach Boys because it's just not many people can do those harmonies and that Beach Boy sound. So you've just got to do, everyone wants to be the Beatles, but no one can sing like McCartney, you know?
No.
So you've only got your own, so you've got to do that.
Yeah. Love it.
You've got to, you know, you've just got to deal with the tools that you've been given.
Wonderful. Well, where can people find your stuff? That's because you've done how many albums was it? Five, six albums?
Five albums. I actually did a best of.
The best of
came out late last year, just to sort of bookend those five albums, which I've done with the same producer. And like I say, I'm moving on to someone out with Hawley's band. So I wanted to just put a little package. So yeah, that's out there. The usual spaces, wherever you get your music from, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's out there. If you want to dip your toe in the best of Nev Cotti, you know, it's there. And yeah, five albums. You know, I'm loving it. I love it because it was really freeing finding that I could, because I always had to have a singer. I wrote these songs, and it's like, well, I can't sing it, so I've got to have Greg. I've got to have such a body, and it was really liberating to sort of be able to sing my own song. So. Hence the deluge of like five albums in 9 years or 10 years, whatever it is, you know.
But that's great, isn't it? If you can do that, like of, you know, Andy Bell was a good example of that, because I think I interviewed Andy Bell and it was like David Bowie's death that really kicked him into gear, because he just thought, well, fucking hell, if Bowie's gone, like, why have I been sitting around waiting 3 years to do an album? Let's just get on with it. And he has just been putting out everything. You know, he's putting out so much stuff. Why not? You know, get out there and do it. Absolutely.
Well, totally. I mean, all our heroes, you talk about the Beatles, Beach Boys, they were releasing an album a year and singles that weren't on the album in between that, sometimes two albums a year. Prolific. That's how they operated, you know? So I set myself a target of like one every 2 years. I think that in the modern era, on my own, you know, I'm not in a band. I'd love to do one every sort of 6 months, but it's just not feasible and whatnot. But bands are lazy now. Get off your ass and get writing an album and get it out. And then when that's done, do another one. You know, and the people decide what lasts and what they want to listen to. If you can do it, go and do it. Don't hang about, yeah.
That's the message, man. That's the message. Well, look, we'll finish off. Did you have a particular Oasis song that like means a lot to you, or would you say it was your favourite song and why?
I like the first single. I think that's the best single they've ever released. I think it's fresh. It came out of nowhere because I'd never heard them do that live. And then he recorded it with my mate Dave Scott over in Liverpool. And I think it sounds great. And I think it still sounds great. And it just sounds clean and fresh. And it's obviously, it was done quickly. There's not much thought. It's not overproduced. And for me, that's the quintessential recording of Oasis. I think they really captured it there, that they didn't really get on a lot of other stuff. You know, the live, that sort of energy of the live performance and the guitars and great songwriting. So that, for me, that's the best one. Supersonic.
Awesome. Supersonic. All right, well, we'll finish with a little bit of Supersonic. But Nev, thank you. Shut up, dog. Nev, thank you very much for your time, mate. Really appreciate it. And catch you down the line. Cheers, mate. All the best.
Cheers. Have a good
day. Great to speak. Bye. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Okay, thank you very much to Nev. Really, really enjoyed that. I had no idea that he was like the roadie for the Yayas and all that sort of stuff. And I love that story about just driving down to the studio to try and audition for Bonehead's part. So absolutely amazing stuff. Brilliant to talk to Nev, and we'll hopefully get him on again because, what a good guy, knowledgeable about music, probably so many more stories to get into. So, yeah, fantastic. That will do us. Thank you very much for listening to the Oasis podcast. Most of all, thanks go to our patrons. You can become a patron at patreon.com/oasispod, which is where we post a bonus episode. Sometimes we post the episodes with full tracks, so they're like radio shows. All good stuff over there. One thing I'm going to be doing there shortly, actually, is ranking the current best song at the Brit Awards nominations. I did it last year. I'm going to do it again this year. Bit of fun. And so do please feel free to support me over there for as little as £1 or $1 per month. Give us a follow on socials where you can, at Oasis Podcast on Twitter, or X is like the main place to go, really. And always feel free to drop me an email, oasispod@gmail.com, if you want to give your thoughts on the recent Liam and John news or anything else. New music submissions, always happy to have them pinged over. So look forward to hearing from you. Anyway, that'll do it. We will be back very soon, and episode 250 is coming up. So I really want to do something interesting for episode 250. So watch this space. Right. Stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young.